very much. Welcome to the Health and Human Services Committee. If I don't look like Senator Hahn, I know. Today we have two bills on the agenda. Senator Hall, you have Senate File 1679 in front of us.
We do. Thank you, Madam Chair. And senators, members, this is the first hearing on Senate File 1679. I would like to start out, if I may, by moving the A2 author's amendment.
Senator Hall moves the A2 amendment. Members, let's see, do we have that in front of us? Senator Hall, can you just give us a brief explanation? I believe
sure.
That is being passed out at this moment.
Yeah, the amendment acknowledges a sunset commission under Section 3D.21 and adjusts the expiration date of the councils to 2014 to be consistent with the DHS review before the Sunset Commission.
Ooh, thank you. Senator Hall, we'll wait till it's all passed out.
Okay. The
members have a chance to look at it. Does it delete all
amendment? And Madam Chair, this is
Senator Fischbach.
It's an author's amendment, correct? This is the first time.
Senator Hall?
Yes.
Any questions on the A2 amendment, members? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Senator Hall.
Thank you. This is a Department of Human Services bill that I'm authoring, and because of my cold today, I'm going to let Mr. Reuter explain the bill and take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reuter. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Madam Chair and committee members, my name is Thomas Reuter. I'm the Manager of Legislative and Stakeholder Relations for the Chemical and Mental Health Administration with the Department of Human Services. Senate File 1679 extends four advisory councils that were scheduled to expire on June 30th of 2012. With the adopted amendments, this brings that extension to 2014 and brings the governing statutes in alignment with the Sunset Commission. Under Section 1 of the bill, the American Indian Advisory Council is extended. This advisory council was established in 1984, and it provides insight and guidance between the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division of DHS and each of the tribes and urban American Indians on needs, grants, and funding services for American Indians. Likewise, the Citizens Advisory Council under Section 2 was established in 1973. It also advises the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division on problems of alcohol and drug abuse, prevention, and treatment. Under Section 3, the Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Council was established in 1992. It provides recommendations to the department on program development and concerns about health and human services needs for persons with traumatic brain injury. And under the final section of the bill, the American Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council was established in 1999. And it provides recommendations to the department on policies and procedures relating to Indian child welfare services. I can certainly go into more detail if you'd like about each of the councils, or I can receive questions.
Thank you, Mr. Reuter. Is there any questions at this moment? Senator Fischbach.
Madam Chair.
Thomas Reuter.
Explain to me, you mentioned the Sunset Commission, 3D.21, it's referenced a couple of times, and I could go look it up, but I thought maybe if you had a quick explanation for it. It's on it's on line 118, and it's referenced a couple of times. It is the Sunset Commission, that is. Okay, all right, thank you. They actually answered my question because I was just making sure that that was the reference to the Sunset Commission. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Reuter, we're just going to give a chance to have everybody catch their breath if there's any questions about this bill. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reuter, could you tell me if there's any federal grant dollars that are on the line with these or associated with these commissions?
Mr. Reuter.
I can speak specifically for the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Citizens Advisory Council and the American Indian Advisory Council. We receive a $23 million federal block grant, a substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant. And the requirement of the grant requires that these two advisory councils exist to advise on how treatment is delivered in the state of Minnesota, on how those dollars are spent, on prevention, and the costs to operate those two advisory councils are also part of that $23 million federal block grant.
Okay. Mr. Reuter, in Section 3, you're extending the Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Committee to 2016 also. Is that correct?
It should be 2014 with the amendment.
2014. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Reuter. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a comment. I've looked at this, and I think what I'm going to do is honor the decision by previous legislators in allowing these commissions to expire. I mean, I think too often we set boards and commissions up to undertake a specific task, and they somehow become embedded in our culture forever after there. So in this case, it would be my intention not to support the bill. I will vote against it.
Senator Newman. Any further questions? Anybody would like to testify on the bill?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Twyla Braze. I'm president of Citizens Council for Health Freedom, and our mission is to support patient and doctor freedom, medical innovation, and the right of citizens to a confidential patient-doctor relationship. And so patient and doctor freedom really require smaller governments, not bigger governments. And I realize that these advisory groups have been around for years. I did some research. The Citizens Advisory Council was enacted in 1973, almost 40 years ago. The American Indian Advisory Council was established in 1984, almost 30 years ago, and the Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Committee was enacted in 1991, more than 20 years ago. I looked up some history on the advisory groups, and in 1997, a law required a list of 60 advisory groups and committees to expire in 2001. Two of the groups in our discussion today, the Citizens Advisory Council and the American Indian Advisory Council, actually expired in 2001. However, the law apparently did not disappear from the statutes, and I found that in 2004, the language was amended from a 2001 expiration date to a 2008 expiration date, and the additional language that was added in the bill said the following: this section is effective retroactively from June 30th, 2001. So I could be wrong, but it appears the advisory group continued to meet without any legislative authority required in statute. Now, I talked to a Miss Amy Delwood at the department, and she said that the money going for these committees is for mileage and per diem, and the total is $23,000 a year for the three committees. But the cost is higher. She told me that the staffing time is considered administrative work for developing policy and thus is not specifically itemized. She told me that the advisory councils permit the department to pull together a group of people, but I asked if the department could have a meeting even if it wasn't in statute. And she agreed that it could, and thus I believe it did from 2001 to 2004. The continued and growing impact of federal mandates on states, state legislations, and the state budget is an ever-increasing concern. With the federal taxpayer dollars come federal strings. But with two of these committees from 2001 to 2004, it appears that the feds didn't pull the dollars when the advisory committees weren't in law. So I'd like to suggest that the feds are not going to pull the resources just because Minnesota decides to cut an advisory group, and that the group can actually meet without it being in statute. Now, finally, now that I have heard about the $23 million, it caused me to wonder about accountability over the $23 million, the federal dollars that are coming into the state, and whether or not you all know what's happening to those federal dollars or how they're being used. And I wonder if approving the advisory committee gives implicit authority to spend the federal dollars that you may or may not have any accountability or know what's happening. And so I don't know what's happening to these funds. I'm concerned that perhaps it's building slush funds in the departments if there's no accountability at the state level for how it's being used by state departments. So I guess my concern is that the building growth of government, and in addition to that now the $23 million, which I don't know that we have any authority over, but that this particular agreement to say yes to the advisory committee could be the implicit authority to say yes to the $23 million. And I bring that to your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Brace, for your testimony. Ms. Brace, can you mention again what that $23 million was for? I heard 23,000. I heard 23 million.
Yes, thank you.
17,000.
For the it's 23,000 for the three advisory groups. It's 17,000 for the two having to do with the 23 million, and then it's $23 million for those two grant programs that Mr.
Reuter
mentioned.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Reuter. Would you like to explain the 23 million?
Madam Chair and committee members, the $23 million is the substance abuse treatment block grant that we received from the federal government to the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Division. And that block grant is used for prevention activities, for treatment that is delivered to individuals who have a substance abuse addiction, as well as a variety of educational type of activities.
So, Mr. Reuter, this is the state dollars. Is there a federal match with that?
That is the federal dollars.
That is the federal dollars. So this is there's really no state share except the $23,000 for the three committees. Is that correct?
It's about $17,000 for the three advisory councils to operate, and those for the for the Citizens Advisory Council and the American Indian Advisory Council, those dollars are not state dollars. They come out of the $23 million federal block grant as part of the administration of the activities that are required to that grant.
Mm-hmm. So, Mr. Reuter, if these councils are eliminated, are you still eligible to receive the federal block grant?
Madam Chair, I'm hesitating because I believe that we would be putting at risk the receipt of the $23 million federal block grant.
Oh. Welcome to the committee. Hi.
Thank you.
Please state your name.
My name is Jody Greenstein, and I'm here as the chair of the 2011-12 Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Committee.
Welcome, Ms. Greenstein.
Thank you. I wanted to share my thoughts about the importance of citizens being involved in an advisory committee on a governmental level, especially for individuals who have brain injuries. Brain injury is a hidden disability and a growing disability, and the involvement of individuals with brain injuries and their families in the committee has been vital to ensure that we're providing the services that are beneficial to them in the community.
Ms. Greenstein, do you know Mr. Jay Walters?
I do.
He's a constituent of mine, and he's very active on this advisory council and keeps me on the straight and narrow of
yes.
what's happening and how important the Traumatic Brain Injury Council is going forward. So I appreciate you coming up and testifying on this.
Thank you.
Senator Hall, do you have any questions or anything you'd like to? Any questions? Do you have any questions? Do you have any comments that you'd like to make?
No. Except that I know the governor's behind this, and it's a department bill. We'd like to move it forward.
Okay. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the $23 million in federal dollars that goes to treatment prevention, how long have you been receiving these grants?
Mr. Reuter.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, since 1996.
Since 1996. And Madam Chair.
Senator Benson.
Can you show us the evidence that these are reducing alcohol and drug abuse in the targeted populations?
Mr. Reuter.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, we have we've discussed, the department has come prior to this committee and talked about the DANES information that we have. And that information can is data that's that reviews how effective the treatment is delivered within the state. And I believe that we do have data that could support the effectiveness of spending the $23 million block grant. So I can certainly work with you and get that information.
Senator Sharon.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. I know that we've had a review of effectiveness of our initiatives for the treatment of drug and alcohol as early as last year. We reviewed much of this. But is there something in this bill that, other than the suggestion that supporting advisory processes is somehow giving implicit support to federal dollars, other than that, is there anything in this bill related to the federal grants other than establishing the opportunity for special groups to advise and have a positive impact on the course and the direction in which treatment for their groups occur in the state? Is there anything in this bill that's related to the $23 million other than the existence of these advisory groups?
Mr. Reuter?
I could say it another way, excuse me, Senator. If we vote for or against this, does... is voting against this a way of cutting out $23 million of federal money for the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Reuter.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, I believe that the way the agreement is with the federal government presently, voting against this bill would put at risk all of the funding that is associated with the federal block grants for substance abuse prevention, as well as the dollars that are received for the traumatic brain injury.
Thank you. Thank you. I think it explains why there might have been a retroactive date to protect dollars that were already expended. And I think besides the fact that including more people who have a unique perspective to influence the outcome of dollars spent, for which I would support continuing these advisory committees, I think that the issue of that's being raised here about whether or not we should participate in federal funding is this is not the way to deal with it. And I would ask that when this comes to a vote that we have a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. A roll call will be given. Further comments? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this isn't for me about trying to prevent the use of federal dollars. It's making sure that we're getting results. We can have advisory panels and we can, you know, have people sit around and talk about direction, but we need to substance abuse is a very serious issue. And if we're spending money and not seeing actual improvements in the targeted populations, then the advisory council is not doing a good job, and we shouldn't authorize them. And I don't recall the specific reports that you presented earlier this year, and I apologize for not doing due diligence in that sense. I have concern that we have a lot of people in meetings over and over and over again, and we never say enough, restart. It's time to take a different approach. And so that is my hesitation in continuing to move things forward that have been over and over again stopped and restarted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reuter.
Madam Chair and Senator Benson, I think it's important to remember that the advisory councils provide a citizen involvement in how services and prevention services are delivered, how public policy around substance abuse and prevention and traumatic brain injury is developed, what that public policy looks like, and as well as monitoring, are we delivering quality services to the people who need them? So it provides a citizen voice to how dollars are spent as well. And the other thing that I think it is important to remember is that with the amendment, we have tied the language to the Sunset Commission, which will review the existence of these councils in 2014 as the Sunset Commission looks at the Department of Human Services and all of the functions underneath the department.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reuter, first of all, there are other ways. You don't need an advisory council to have citizens have input. I get phone calls all the time in my office. I'm a citizen legislator. We have advocacy groups that come to us. So that number one. But my question is, if these dollars would be at risk because we would get rid of this commission, then why the sunset in the first place? Why don't they just go on in perpetuity?
Mr. Reuter.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, I believe that the purpose behind tying it to the Sunset Commission was to allow for adequate time to explore the possibilities that could exist around whether or not these advisory councils needed to continue or not, and what potentially would be the risks of not continuing these advisory councils.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I would make the comment that these advisory committees that or commissions that we're talking about, 1973, 1984, and 1991, it's 2012. And if we haven't figured out by now if these committees or commissions are worthwhile in doing their job, I don't know when we're going to. Those recommendations, if from my understanding and being here, these commissions are set up to give recommendations to the legislature and then to sunset. These aren't sunsetting. This is a perpetual problem. It's a growth of government that's causing spending, and it's people say to me it's $17,000, but it's $17,000 here and $17,000 there. And I look through our audience here all the time, and I see all kinds of people sitting in here from the department, and I'm wondering how much money we're spending having the department sitting in committee meetings, and these are taxpayer dollars, and so we are not sunsetting these commissions. These recommendations clearly aren't being met, so I'm not going to support this bill.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that this capital is almost like a hermetically sealed daycare center, and everybody's a Typhoid Mary. So I think that. Let the record reflect that Senator Hayden is the one that gave me my call. I think that Senator Sharon asked a very appropriate question, and the answer that she received, I felt, was an equivocation. I didn't hear clearly that the passage of this bill is going to jeopardize the federal funds. What I heard was, I think it might. And so, you know, here again, I have a very difficult time understanding how a citizen commission and its ongoing function is going to jeopardize federal funding when, at least in my opinion, clearly it's the function of the legislature. So here again, we have got three commissions that have been established for years, and there is hesitancy in allowing them to expire as anticipated by a previous legislature. And I just think that there comes a time when we just have to move on. So I candidly didn't hear an answer to Senator Sharon's question that was clear and concise.
I think, Senator Newman, there is on the background information, though, that in Section 1 and 2, it is required by SAMHSA for the federal block grant to have these the American Indian Advisory Council and the Citizens Advisory Council. So it is required in order for them to get the federal grant. I'm not sure, Mr. Reuter, if you have a comment to that.
Madam Chair, could you restate the question?
Well, Senator Newman was saying he had not heard definitively if there was if these councils had to be in place to receive the federal block grant, and I'm just addressing what is printed here that it is required. These councils must be in place in order for the substance abuse grant to come forward.
Madam Chair, presently they are the identification of citizen participation is a component of the federal block grant for the substance abuse prevention and treatment block grant.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Senator. Hey,
I'm sorry.
Senator Hayden.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And, you know, I think when I start to think about, I mean, I've kind of walked through this Sunset Commission provisions, and I think it's been healthy to take a look at all of the boards and advisory councils that we have. And I don't know, you know, and I've fought for my fair share. I don't know if I think it is a wise decision to take a look at them. I think it is very wise for us to think about the information that they've been providing the legislature, or if they've been providing the information to the legislature. And so when I start thinking about reform, I not only think about is it needed, or are we getting the most bang for our buck, but I also look at the population in which the groups are trying to help. Because what is clear is that we still have an issue of substance abuse in our state. It is clear that substance abuse, depending upon your frame of reference, but my frame of reference is that it's a disease. It is something that people often get, and they don't know how to handle it. They don't know kind of what's happening to them, and they need therapy in which to deal with the issue. And so to think about it in the context of the folks that we're trying to serve, and then how do we build groups that help us, because with all due respect to this legislative body, we are citizen legislature, and we often go back to our real jobs and real world, and we need people to help us each and every session to come and tell us kind of what's going on in the community, not only in terms of what's happening to people, what are the environmental factors that are happening in each community, but also what are the best practices? How do we deal with these issues? How do we move forward? How do we think about our workforce development in the future and have people not kind of enduring and suffering through a lot of these issues? Not only chemical dependency, but I noticed that there was a traumatic brain injury program. That often happens as a result of an injury or something that people just driving down the road happens. And so I know that it is important to take a look at this. I think what is important to me and why the Sunset Commission is important is that we look at how the work is being done and make sure that the commissions and the advisory boards are coming back to the legislature and informing them as to what the best practices are, what are the issues that are happening, and what are the things that we could be doing much better to kind of help all Minnesotans. And so I am going to support this, but I do say this, and this might be a little bit of a surprise, that I really think we need to work much harder at this. I think we need to build in a lot more accountability to this issue. We need to really hear from you a lot more in and out of session to be sure that the money that we're spending, that we're getting the most bang out of our buck. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And I know that often with these issues, there's not a cure. But I do want to make sure that you guys are coming to us, you're telling us, and you're coming up with not only just a report, but with real ideas, with real best practices on how we best should be going back, what are the laws that we need to develop and policies we need to develop to kind of help people that are in need. And so with that, I will continue to support this, but I do think that in the coming years, as we have moved the sunset off to 2016, I will be, and I hope that we will be as a committee, watching really closely to ensure that you just aren't going and doing business as usual and just there, because I think that's the underlying premise that I hear about boards and commissions, as they're just kind of there, you know, $20,000 here, $100,000 there, but you actually are providing the information, best practices, and we are kind of moving towards a way in which we can manage this disease, we can prevent it if necessary, and we can do the intervention as appropriate. So,
thank you, Senator Hayden, and I do have to just make a few comments. I totally agree with you. I think this should be looked at. However, it would be very detrimental to the movement that has been going forward to not allow these federal dollars to come in and work with substance abuse. And I know for many of us that have been here a long time with the meth legislation, these councils were extremely important in working with the different various groups that were affected by methamphetamine. You could not treat the Indian population the same as you would the teenage population or the reoccurring meth addict. So for a lot of the information that came forward on that meth bill came from the advisory groups, came from citizens saying, this is what's going on out there. But I think it is prudent to continue to take a look at them, make sure these councils are doing due diligence, and that you that's why you have that Sunset Commission going forward. So I appreciate the information that whether it's traumatic brain injury or the Indian Council, whoever, I think that information is extremely important. We live in our little conclave up here, and sometimes we forget to reach out. But Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have a question. You said that there was a requirement to show evidence of citizen participation. You didn't specifically say there had to be regular meetings of an advisory council. And so I'm wondering if there's another mechanism that other states use as they're managing these block grants in conjunction with the department. Because unless you specifically have to have monthly meetings and so forth, let's not put too much bureaucracy in place. The other question I have, the A2 amendment allows for a sunset of 2014, but you reference the Substance and Mental Health Services Administration federal block grant expiring on June 30th, 2016. So why would we sunset in the middle of a block grant if the requirement is that these advisory councils be in place in order to be eligible for the block grant? So I need some clarification.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I believe that the amendment, the date in the amendment, the intent there was to tie it to the review of the Sunset Commission and to determine if there was an alternative mechanism that could be used. I've just recently found out that the 2014 application for the Substance Abuse Treatment and Prevention Block Grant requires an advisory council to be in place. And there are a number of states that also have that have the same sort of requirement with respect to advisory councils and citizen participation as part of the distribution of those dollars to the states from the federal government.
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, I'm still not clear as to why you're okay with sunsetting in the middle of a block grant if the advisory council is required for the block grant.
Mr. Reuter.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the amendment directs the decision to sunset the advisory council to the Sunset Commission. And so it ties the date that's in the Sunset Commission statute to the date that's in this bill. So when the Sunset Commission is looking at the function of the Department of Human Services in 2014, they will also be looking at the sunsetting or the continuation of these four advisory councils at that time. So
Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Madam Chair. It seems like in the years that I've been here, we sometimes set in place new advisory commissions, and they may or may not have had an expiration date. And then somewhere along the line, I remember Senator Kiskaden from Rochester really taking an interest in this. And then at that point, we sort of routinely put a 2-year or a 4-year sunset on everything when it came before us. And the idea was for us to make a determination on whether the councils were doing a good job. Well, as we see in working in a committee environment, we don't really ever take the time to look through and ask the deep questions and go into depth on a lot of what our councils are doing. And so then the Sunset Commission came into place. Great idea. So now we're moving these all to the year that these are affected by the Sunset Commission. Right? I think I'm right, Senator Hall, right? Yes. Mm-hmm. So I think this just only makes sense. Let's let the organization who we've given trust to do that in-depth work of figuring out whether our boards and commissions and councils are doing the work that they should do. Give them a chance to work. That's what we put them in place for. And I just also want to echo what you, Madam Chair, and Senator Hayden said about the work of the councils. I especially think it's important on the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Council that there are people who are who their interests or training are in the field of alcohol dependency and abuse. And that could include treatment providers. And, you know, as our state is growing, we need more more people who are culturally competent in our in the various cultures who are now Minnesotans. And this is a way that our Department of Human Services doesn't get itself sideways with our emerging citizens, our emerging immigrants, and also working with some of our councils of color, some of our communities of color who have been here for a long time and may struggle with alcohol or substance abuse or any of the other things that we work at. The traumatic brain injury doesn't usually cross cultures, but it may be another place where we start looking where that's appropriate to add members who have that experience and that knowledge. But I'm going to support your bill, Senator Hall. I think it's a good thing to do. We've got to make sure that the information that we get. Senator Newman talked about the hermetically sealed Capitol, and I think sometimes we are hermetically sealed. You think of it in germs. I think of it in knowledge. And sometimes we, you know, it's the cone of silence once again. We're here, but sometimes we don't hear what's going on outside this building. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Hayden.
I just have a quick question, Madam Chair. I just noticed, and sorry for me being late, I just noticed that we are taking up not only the advisory councils for alcohol and drugs and traumatic brain injury, but the American Indian Council. I just, as kind of a point of clarification, is I'm just trying to understand why that's in this committee.
Very good question. Senator Hayden, Council, anybody? Answer that?
For the jurisdiction?
Mr. Reuter.
Madam Chair, you are referring to the American Indian Child Welfare Council.
Oh, is that what it is? Subdivision 2.
Section 4.
Oh, okay. I thought it was the American Indian Council.
There's. Madam Chair.
Mr. Reuter.
Senator Hayden. There are two American Indian Advisory Councils as part of this bill. The first one is in Section 1, and it has to do with the federal block grant associated with alcohol and drug abuse prevention and treatment. The second one is in Section 4 of this bill and is the American Indian Child Welfare Advisory Council.
You. Okay, I got it now.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Thank you. My name is Patricia Winnick.
Ms. Patricia Winnick?
Winnick. Winnick, yes. I'm a member of the Traumatic Brain Injury Advisory Committee. As an individual with a brain injury, the Traumatic Brain Injury Committee is hugely important. My voice represents the voice of many people who live with traumatic brain injuries in the state. I know somebody had mentioned earlier that we certainly can speak to our senators and our legislators, which is true. But my voice and my participation on the committee is making recommendations to the Department of Human Services, looking at best practices and how to best serve people in the state who are living with brain injuries. And we do important work. We have a federal, or a state has a federal grant looking at the incidence of brain injury in the correction system. It's huge. It's like in the 80, 90 percentile. So, and looking at ways to prevent, ways to prevent people from coming into corrections. We are cross-cultural as far as looking at the impact of brain injury on communities of culture. The corrections has a specific focus on looking at the American Indian population, how to best serve them within the correction system. So we do a lot of work, mm-hmm. and I feel like my having a voice in making recommendations to DHS is way more powerful than speaking to my elected representatives. So I really hope that this sunset bill passes. And actually, my wish is, why don't we go into, why do we have a sunset date? Because brain injury is a growing population. We're also involved with veterans, looking at veterans. I mean, that's a population that's going to be coming into getting state services. Anyway.
Thank you, Ms. Winnick. Any questions for Testifier? Oh, thank you. Senator Sharon.
I just want to thank you for your service, and I value it significantly. I really think that for the bill that's here today, it really allows these commissions to continue while a reasonable process goes to demonstrate what you are articulating, that you have a value and that you add to a better outcome in this state because you exist. Now, Senator Benson says maybe this isn't the best method and that we might review and see if there might be a better way in which to make certain that how we expend resources creates better outcomes in terms of citizen input. I think that's a reasonable thing to ask about and evaluate, and what the Sunset Commission can do. But what's in front of us today is an extension of the existing system to allow that group to have an opportunity to do its work and to position the state in a way that we can continue to not create any threat to the possibility of drawing down money that's needed for services for these organizations. And that's the essence of what this bill is about. And I think it would be unwise for us to undermine what the Sunset Commission is doing. And I think it would be unwise for us to do anything that has any possibility of undermining our receipt of money in this state to treat this very vulnerable population.
Any questions? Senator Hall?
Okay, Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 1679.
As amended,
and refer to State Government of Innovations and Veteran Affairs.
Thank you, Senator Hall. A roll call has been requested. Roll call will be taken. Secretary will take the roll. The chair votes yes.
Benson.
No.
Fishbach.
Yes.
Hall.
Yes.
Hayden.
Yes.
Higgins.
Yes.
Hoffman.
No.
Lori. Marty.
Yes.
Newman.
No.
Nino.
No.
Sharon.
Yes.
It would be 7 yes and 4 noes. The motion prevails. The bill passes. Thank you, Senator Hall. Thank you, Mr. Reuter. We have Senate File 1804, Senator Hand's bill in front of us, and I believe Senator Nienau is going to be taking honors. Oh boy. Do we have him in front of us? Senator Newman, or Nienau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I get that in multiple committees. That's okay. Madam Chair, I guess to kick things off, I'll move Senate File 1804. I guess this does need to go to Judiciary after this committee, so that's where, if it moves out of this committee, where it would need to go to next.
Okay. Senator Nienau moves Senate File 1804.
Madam Chair, this is the first hearing, and Senator Hand did have an author's amendment that he was going to offer, but I'll offer that on his behalf. That's the A3 amendment, and Madam Chair, we could probably just go into explanation of that amendment as we go into explanation of the bill.
Madam Senator Chair. Now, can you please move your microphone a little bit closer?
Well, is this better?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, I think so. A little noisy. Members, we have the A3 amendment in front of us. Senator O'Neill, now you move the A3 amendment? You've moved the A3 amendment?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes. Okay, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 1804 is a human services policy regarding long-term care, health care, chemical, mental health services. Most of the provisions from the long-term care and health care passed last year unanimously and off the Senate floor, but the conference committee didn't get everything finished up before the end of session. We do have a number of staff from the department that would like to address the various sections of the bill. Madam Chair, if I could just let them take
Thank
it from
you,
here.
Senator Nino. Who would like to go first? Welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Hi, my name is Heidi Hamilton with the Continuing Care Administration. I'm going to cover Articles 1 and 3. I'm not planning on walking through section by section unless you have specific questions on the language, but I'll just talk about the general topics that are included in those articles. I'll work off the original bill language first, and then I'll go through the author's amendment, starting with Article 1 and then moving to Article 3. As Senator Nienau mentioned, a lot of these provisions were included in last year's bill, and so I'll indicate that when they are items from last year that were already passed out of the Senate and when they are new provisions. The first section in Article 1 addresses nursing facility hardship provisions. These provisions allow for geographic areas of Minnesota to be recognized as lacking needed nursing facility services, and they can be allowed to have an exception to the nursing facility bed moratorium. In 2011, there were two separate bills that were traveling that amended the hardship provisions. The one that passed was not the version that was preferred by the department, and so this language attempts to correct that by adding a clause that says the facility does not have its operating rate adjusted unless the increase in beds are at least 50% or more of the facility's capacity. Also related to nursing facilities, there are obsolete sections of statute repealed in Section 11 and then cross-reference updates in Sections 2 and 4 through 7 due to those repealers. Sections 3 and 9 of Article 1 address adult foster care license capacity. This is new language that was not included in last year's policy bill. In 2009, language passed that allowed adult foster care providers to have a capacity of 5 beds through June 30th, 2011. We have amended the CADI and the BI waivers to allow this. The DD waiver is currently in the renewal process, and that change will be made to the DD waiver then. And then the CAC waiver, we are submitting an amendment for that waiver. So because it's past June 30th, 2011, and we haven't amended all the waivers yet, we're proposing to extend the deadline until June 30th, 2014.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I'm good at acronyms, but I didn't catch all of those.
Okay. Ms. Hamilton.
Sorry, I apologize for that. Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, these are the home and community-based waivers for individuals with disabilities. And so the CADI is the community alternative for disabled individuals, and then the brain injury waivers are the waivers where we have amended the language. The developmental disabilities waiver is in the process of being amended, and then the community alternative care waiver, which is the hospital level of care waiver, we will be submitting an amendment for that waiver.
This has made a lot more sense. Thank you.
Okay. Section 8 of the bill relates to adult protection data management, and this is new in the 2012 bill. In 2008, DHS developed and implemented a centralized database to capture vulnerable adult maltreatment report information. This includes information that is reported to the common entry point, as well as information regarding adult protection investigations. The database is maintained within the Social Services Information System, or SSIS. The amended language clarifies the authority of the Commissioner of Human Services to maintain the database and to receive data from lead investigative agencies. This is current practice, so we're just updating the language to comply with current practice. And then we're also, in Section 11, repealing some rule references related to adult protection. Section 10 of Article 1 relates to private duty nursing, and this is also new in the 2012 policy bill. During 2011, DHS transitioned to a new contract with a new vendor to perform the review and authorization of home care services. That transition showed that we need more clarification in statute so that the private duty nursing assessments are consistent, and that will reduce the number of appeals that the department is receiving on those assessments. DHS has been and will continue gathering information from providers and working with stakeholders to determine what changes we need to recommend to statute. The proposed language this year modifies the forms that the commissioner uses to collect that information from providers about the levels of private duty nursing hours that are authorized. So that information will help DHS in consultation with stakeholders to make more informed policy decisions and will assist in the fiscal analysis for any proposed changes to the program in 2013. Those are all of Article 1 included in the bill, and next I'll go through what we've added to Article 1 in the amendment. All of these provisions were in the 2011 policy bill, so I'll just review them briefly, but please ask questions if you have any. The first is amendments related to the community residential setting license and the quality outcome standards language that passed in 2009. The proposed language ties the development of the community residential setting license with the quality outcome standards so that we're not developing two sets of standards, but it all fits within the quality outcome standards. Also, we are excluding customized living services from the quality outcome standards because that service license is under the jurisdiction of the Department of Health. And then it also includes provisions to allow the commissioner to better track when a foster care setting is and is not the primary residence of the license holder. This is important because a lot of our policy language relates to corporate foster care, and that's okay. That is a setting when the license holder is not the it's not the primary residence of the license holder, so we just need a better way to track that. Also included in the language is the expansion of the limitation on receiving other services while receiving the family support grant, and the expansion includes all home and community-based waivers, PCA services, or the consumer support grant. Currently, the limitation only applies to individuals receiving the DD waiver. The language eliminates two annual waiver reports and one biennial quality assurance report and creates a new single biennial report that will provide a summary of the overarching goals and priorities of the department for individuals with disabilities. One of the main components of the waiver reports that people are interested in is the waiting list data, and we are in the process of putting that information on our public website, so it will be updated quarterly and people can access it whenever they want to. There's also a change in the statutory authority for the public guardianship rule to eliminate the requirement for quarterly reporting. This change in statute will allow rulemaking to occur so that we can change the we can make the actual change in the requirements. And the reason for this change is to come in line with the requirements for private guardianship, which currently require annual reports. There is also a change to the consumer support grant budget methodology in statute to align with the changes to the PCA program that were made in 2009. And then finally, in Article 1 in the amendment, there's changes to PCA statute, which allows DHS to fully implement the 2009 and 2010 legislative changes to the program. These changes include provisions that eliminate inconsistencies in statute and comply with federal waiver and state plan requirements. I can pause here and see if there are any questions related to Article 1. Otherwise, I can move on to Article 3.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Any questions for Article 1? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Could you point me to the page and line number that you were talking about, which deals with rulemaking and guardianships?
Ms. Newman.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, this is in the amendment, and it's page 4, line 19, section 8 of the amendment.
Madam Chair, I have no further
follow-up
question. I just want to know where it was so I could read it.
Okay, thank you. Ms. Hamilton. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Article 3 is on the comprehensive assessment and case management. Many of the changes in Article 3 are related to establishing consistency in terminology across the home and community-based waivers, PCA, and private duty nursing for implementation of the MIN Choices Assessment Tool and Case Management Reform. Most of these changes were included in the 2011 policy bill, and I will highlight those changes that were not included. For some background on MIN Choices, in 2009, the legislature authorized the department to develop and implement a new assessment process and standards, as well as a web-based data collection tool called MIN Choices. And this would be required for all individuals in Minnesota needing long-term care services. MIN Choices will simplify and standardize face-to-face assessments and consolidate assessment processes for long-term care services, including HCBS and home care. This new tool replaces four current separate assessment tools and will be used with approximately 80,000 individuals each year. The consolidated processes will be accomplished by adding a new assessor certification requirement that ensures competency and reliability in evaluating individuals' long-term care needs, modifying the assessment and service planning process by requiring the development of individualized service plans that include coordination with appropriate community-based services as well as informal and quasi-formal supports, and establishing the necessity for services that are included in the plan, and establishing a new payment methodology for the new assessment process. In addition to MIN Choices changes in Article 3, in 2010, the legislature required DHS to consult with stakeholders to redesign case management services for individuals with disabilities. Included in that is the definition of administrative case management as opposed to the service functions of case management. There's also standardization and simplification of the processes, standards, and timelines for case management, waiting list, and quality assurance. And then also increasing opportunities for consumer choice of case management functions. The proposed language accomplishes these items and also changes host county concurrence for the developmental disabilities waiver to host county notification for all waiver programs. It eliminates PCA as an excluded time service for purposes of determining county of financial responsibility. And it also requires the commissioner to continue working with the work group to look for further changes for case management redesign. The language that is new in the 2012 bill includes requiring the certified assessor to provide information to school-age and working-age adults about competitive employment and the different self-directed options. It requires the plan to include the authorized annual and monthly amount of services and the person's choices made on self-directed services and employment goals. It also requires DHS to work with counties, tribes, and stakeholders to evaluate the county and tribal administrative functions, processes, and reimbursement methodologies for the purposes of HCBS waiver administration. That's all that's included in Article 3. Are there any questions related to that article?
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Any questions? Great. Thank you.
Thanks.
Continue, please. Ms. Hamilton, you're done with your...
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I am.
Okay, super. Okay. Senator Nino.
Well, Madam Chair, we now have another staff person here to give us an update on another section of the bill.
Great. Welcome. Thank you. Please state your name.
Hi, I'm Sarah Mahesworn. I'm the administrator for the Department of the Telephony Equipment Distribution Program.
What's your last name? I'm sorry, Sarah.
It's Mahesworn.
Mahesworn. Thank you.
I know it's difficult.
No, it's just difficult for some people, some senators.
Okay. Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm going to be walking through Article 2. The purpose of the TED program is to provide telecommunication equipment to eligible Minnesotans who have a hearing loss, speech, or a physical disability that prevents them from using a standard telephone. The program provides telecommunication equipment as a long-term loan, but it does not pay for the monthly service cost. And there are income guidelines to qualify for the program. As Senator Nino mentioned previously, this was passed by this committee, the Commerce Committee, and the Senate floor last year, but it didn't pass the out-of-conference committee. The language has not changed since then. So I'm just going to go through the three main categories of the changes. The first are technical changes. And basically what we're wanting to do is modernize the statute language by removing obsolete language. And that's throughout the article. The second, an example of that would be changing impaired to disability. The second kind of change we're proposing are policy updates. And there's three main policy updates. One would be in Section 4. This requires DHS to establish policies for the return of equipment when clients are no longer eligible. The second type of policy update we're proposing is to remove language that states that DHS doesn't pay for outside wiring. That's in Section 4. And in Section 7, we wanted to clarify that that relay users can file a complaint with telecommunication providers. And the last type of change that we've made is to clarify program purpose. And there are two different types of clarifications here. One is in Section 1 that clarifies that devices offered through the program are intended to give persons with disabilities functional equivalent access to telecommunication services. And the second clarification is in Section 2, which clarifies current practice of providing devices to individuals based on assessed need. And I'm here for any questions on Article 2.
Thank you, Ms. Mass-Warren. Any questions on Section 2? Thank you very much. Senator Nienow.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Now we move on to which section? Article 4.
Mr. Reuter, welcome back.
Madam Chair, my name is Thomas Reuter with the Department of Human Services. I will be presenting on Article 4 of the bill. Sections 1 through 4 of Article 4 have to do with the change from ICD-9 to ICD-10 codes that that is being required through the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And these sections change our mental health and children's mental health statutes, which reference the ICD-9 codes and broaden the statute to ICD-10 codes and any other future changes in code sets so that we do not need to come before the legislature to change code sets to match what's happening in the market. Sections 5 and 9 repeals the maintenance of effort requirements for children mental health collaboratives and family services collaboratives. This has not been enforced since 2010 when the legislature elected to not enforce specific maintenance of effort requirements. And so we're seeking repeal of that language. Section 6 adds a subdivision necessary to conform to our existing estate recovery language in Minnesota Statute 524-805 for state-operated services around estate claims. It's technical in nature. Section 7 corrects an error from the Chemical and Mental Health Services Policy Bill that was passed into law last session. The error was to implement budget reduction that limited services with a room and board component to individuals who scored a severity 4 in either relapse and continued use or dimension 6, which is recovery environment. It changes the and to an or. So what that means is that a score of the severity level 4 is not required in both dimension 5 and 6, but rather for dimension 5 or 6. And Section 8 conforms existing statutes and corrects a cross-reference in Minnesota Statute 256B 0625 under covered services to refer to the definition of mental health professional as defined in 245.462 and 245.471.
Mr. Reuter, we have questions. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reuter, the error correction from 2009, I just want you to very clearly state there's no fiscal impact. It's already in the budget.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, you adopted a budget last year assuming an or.
Thank you.
And we're trying to correct that this year.
Any other questions? Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Roeder, regarding the Section 6, regarding the statute of limitations, what statute of limitation is being negated?
Mr. Roeder.
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, the statute of limitations that we're referring to is Minnesota Statute 524-805. It is around estate claims and how estate claims are handled in the state for individuals who receive services and state operated services, and it's determined that at the point of service, they are not able to pay for their services. We are required by law to keep those dollars that are owed to the state on the books, and then at the time of the person's death, we would be looking at doing an estate recovery to pay for services that were delivered in a state-operated services facility.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand that explanation. My question is, what's the statute of limitations length? And what is the commissioner proposing to, substitute for that statute of limitations? Is he going to do it by rule? Is it going to come by statute? How's it going to work?
Madam Chair, Senator Newman, the language that you would be adopting in this bill is the language that we would be needing. It is not... It is not tied to a rulemaking process.
Senator Higgins.
Senator Chair.
Senator Newman. Further questions? Excuse me.
I may try one more time.
How long is the look back? Maybe.
What I'm looking at is the summary, because it's literally impossible to follow the bill. So I'm looking at the summary, and what it says is that it modifies the state-operated services section of law, negating any statute of limitations provision that limits the commissioner's ability to recover the cost of care. I understand the claims regarding recovering through a claim against an estate. I understand all of that. What I want to know is what is the statute of limitations? You've given me the site. What is it that is being negated, and what is the commissioner going to propose to use instead of this statute of limitations that is being negated?
Mr. Grutter.
Madam Chair and Senator Newman, I apologize. I have not seen the legislative summary that you are looking at. This piece of language was repealed in 2009, and we believe that we need this piece of language because the existing law does not continue in the fashion that we need. Presently in healthcare, it's typically a healthcare claim is dismissed after 7 years. So what this would be doing is reinstating, actually, language that was repealed in 2009, and because our understanding was that the existing law, 524, would apply, but we have received advice that we need to reinstate Section 246. So under present law, a healthcare claim proceeds for 7 years and continues to be part of a person's obligation for 7 years. And at the end of 7 years, that obligation would expire. Madam Chair and Senator Newman, does that answer your question?
Senator Newman, I think I'll allow Ms. White to.
Yeah.
Madam Chair and Senator and Mr. Roeder, the language does indicate that any statute of limitations is negated. So if you do want to make this provision more narrow to only apply to the provision you were talking about, maybe we should put in a citation there. But there is no
statute that's 524.805. I think that's what the statute site you stated.
Mr. Reeder?
Madam Chair, it's Minnesota statute 524.3-805.
Okay, and Madam Chair and Senator Newman, if you would like this section of law to be more specific, to only apply to that statute of limitations, I can amend that so it only references the 524.3-805.
Senator Newman, this bill does go to judiciary.
It is? Oh, okay.
Yes. All right. So that would be probably the proper place to fix this.
I agree. I thought this may have been a provision that was buried and we wouldn't see it in judiciary. So that would be an appropriate place to take it up.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You bet. Yeah. Senator Higgins.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Reuter, am I understanding? Seems to me we used to have a 5-year look back, and then we changed it to the 7-year look back that you referenced, and now it's going to be an indeterminate. And no number of years look back, so forever and ever, this obligation will be against the person if he or she received health care services through the state until her estate is settled?
Madam Chair, Senator Higgins, this really has to do specifically to services delivered within state-operated services. The cost of care statutes within state-operated services were written in the 1950s, and in 2009, we attempted to update those statutes to reflect modern methods of delivering care and treatment. In the 1950s, when an individual would enter into a regional treatment center, we would do a look at their income and their assets and their liabilities, and then issue a determination order that told the individual what part of the cost of their care they were responsible for. At that time, then, if an individual was unable to pay for their cost of care, we retained that bill on the books until at the point of their death, and then we would look at the estate to determine whether or not the estate could pay any outstanding obligation for the services that were delivered within the regional treatment center. In 2009, we adjusted the statute to account for the fact that most people have insurance now. And so when you come into a state-operated services facility, the first thing we ask you for is your insurance card. And then determining what your patient responsibility is after we've billed the insurance for the services that you've provided. Then we look at your assets and your income to determine what you have the ability to pay. So this really is specific to state-operated services and not specific to the broader provision of publicly funded healthcare programs.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Reuter. That was really a good explanation, except for one thing. What if it's a very young person? Does that just stay on the books till that person gets old and dies? And could it possibly be on the books for 20, 30, 40 years?
Mr. Reuter?
Madam Chair and Senator Higgins, I'm assuming that when you mean a very young person, it would be a young adult.
Yes.
And so the answer is potentially yes. It would stay.
Further questions? Thank you, Mr. Reuter. Senator Nidau, you have another amendment?
Well, Madam Chair, there is another amendment that I'd like to offer up, although I can do that now or we can finish up the overview on the bill. I think we have another.
There's more overview?
I believe we've got another. Maybe okay. Not. Maybe that was the last section.
I guess there is.
Okay. Yeah, I thought we had another section, okay. Madam Chair, and here we go.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Scott Leitz. I'm the Assistant Commissioner at DHS, and sadly, there is more overview.
Welcome, Mr. Leitz.
I'll try to be relatively brief, Madam Chair. This is Article 5 of the bill. Section 1 of Article 5 is really cleanup language from a provision that was proposed last year and was included in various bills throughout the process that related to information that could be transferred out related from the Medicaid and individual education plans. This is a provision that got worked out during session, so the language was not necessary. It was taken out of most of the bill, but this one line was included, and so this just cleans that up to be consistent with the agreement at the end of session. Sections 2, 12, and 13 relate to clarifying some of the cost-sharing provisions that DHS has related to volume purchasing. DHS is currently authorized to use and does use bulk purchasing contracts for eyeglasses for Medicaid recipients. Typically, we would purchase eyeglasses from a manufacturer. We use Vision World or some type of a vendor to actually distribute those glasses, and then clients receive them. There's a small copay on eyeglasses. It's challenging for that copay to be administered because the actual way that we would administer that is to lower the price paid to the vendor, who in this case is actually the wholesaler that we buy from. Vision World is just a pass-through, so there's no practical way for us to actually collect that copay, and so this provision actually just removes that to be consistent with how we have to administer the program. Sections 3, 4, 5, 18, 19, and 22 relate to legislation that was passed in 2009. There was general language that was passed during that year that required DHS to comply with provisions of the Federal American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 related to American Indians. We didn't have specific guidance on how that provision needed to be implemented. We did receive that guidance recently, and this language reflects that more specific guidance that CMS has given us as to how to implement that provision, and really makes clear that premiums are to be waived in Minnesota care for American Indians and their families. Section 6 of the bill relates to a clarification on periods of ineligibility for medical assistance for long-term care services due to an uncompensated transfer. State law that was passed during the 2009 legislative session required that effective January 1st of 2011, periods of ineligibility for MA for long-term care services due to an uncompensated transfer could no longer be recalculated when a portion of the transferred assets were returned. Rather, the law required that the period of ineligibility could only be eliminated if the asset transferred assets or the cash equivalent of them were returned to the enrollee within 12 months of the date of the period of ineligibility began. We submitted a state plan amendment to reflect this change in February of 2011. This provision relates then to bringing us into compliance with the agreement we reached with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. They did approve that state plan amendment in its totality, but required that the provision that all assets be returned within 12 months of the date of the period of ineligibility be removed. So this language really reflects that practice that CMS has required of us. Sections 7, 8, and 9 relate to the first section relates to coverage for active pharmaceutical ingredients, or APIs. These are bulk chemicals that are used by pharmacists to create compounded prescriptions. We've historically covered APIs when they're used in compounded prescriptions as long as that API was eligible for a rebate. CMS has said now that it no longer considers APIs drugs per se, and so they're no longer eligible for a rebate. But they're still a very important component of certain compounded medications, and this proposal just clarifies what situations where coverage of APIs is allowed. While we won't continue to collect any Medicaid rebate on these APIs, the collected amount was really quite negligible, and so therefore, because these are pretty inexpensive components, so there's no fiscal cost to this provision. The second provision here relates to over-the-counter medication dispensing, and it seeks to require that to allow for over-the-counter medications to be dispensed in quantities that are lesser than the manufacturer's package size or the amount needed to complete a course of patient's therapy. Pharmacies who fill prescriptions for long-term care facilities and group homes in particular would like the ability to open packages of vitamins or other over-the-counter drugs so they can package those drugs up with an individual's current course of treatment rather than prescribing it fully as the package says. And so it's really a way to try to ensure safety of the patient and also get them the best possible care at that site. Section 10 relates to medication therapy management services. Current law requires that pharmacists be licensed in Minnesota in order to roll in a medication therapy management program as providers. There are a few providers, however, who operate on the border who are delivering these services to Medicaid clients in Minnesota. This provision allows for us to be able to compensate them for participating in that program as well, or to continue to be reimbursed in that program. That is the current practice now, so there's no fiscal cost to this. This just brings us into alignment with what the current practice is right now. Section 11 relates to fluoride varnish. This is really cleanup language that was passed in 2010, which added oral health services and fluoride varnish application as a preventive service. The word treatment was replaced by varnish in most areas of the statute, but was left in one particular area. This just cleans that up to make it consistent with the rest of the bill. Section 14 relates to a intergovernmental transfer that is for the Metropolitan Health Plan. DHS currently has an intergovernmental transfer arrangement with Hennepin County and Metropolitan Health Plan. Each month, the county transfers approximately $566,000 to DHS. That money has traditionally been used to be paid to MHP, which then it uses it to offset costs at Hennepin County Medical Center for the higher costs that they incur for medical education that they're giving to lower income individuals as part of the work that they do. As part of the competitive bidding process this year, MHP was actually not included as a health plan in Hennepin County. And so what this provision does is just actually allows for that pass-through to occur with the other plans.
Mr. Leitz, we're going to have to wrap this up. Anything that strikes out as being something that we would be concerned?
Madam Chair, I believe the remaining provisions, Section 15, Section 16, Section 17 and actually Section 17, Section 20 are actually really cleanup language of provisions that we just were coming into compliance around things. And the other provisions in the bill, let's see, I believe that is it, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, that is correct.
Thank you, Mr. Leitz. Any question? Senator Sharon, that's fine. Senator Sharon, your microphone.
Page eight, medication therapy management services. The impact of the proposed changes pharmacists and border states that serve Minnesota will be able to No, that's not the one. I'm referring to the one that says the Minnesota. Oh, here it is on page seven, ARRA, American Indians Protection. It says impact of proposed changes makes clear that premiums are waived for American Indians and their families enrolled in Minnesota care. Who pays the how is that resolved? How is that waiver resolved in terms of payment? Is it somebody else responsible for that, or is the state pick that up?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, there simply is no premium for those individuals, and so as that's been implemented, there hasn't been a cost to that, so there remains no cost to that piece. So the premium or the cost-sharing piece really just is coming into compliance with what has been practiced since the passage of that era. And we've now gotten more specific guidance around this. So I believe what occurred at the time, Madam Chair and Senator, was that we implemented this on the likelihood that there would be that would be the removal. And so there was general guidance that we were not to collect premiums. We've now received more specific guidance on that. And the language here simply makes that more explicit in the law, but it reflects current practice.
Thank you very much. Any further questions? Great. Senator Nienau, I believe there is somebody who would like to testify on this section. Actually, Ms. Price. Okay. Thank you. And members, and we're on a short leash here. So, Ms. Brace, welcome.
Thank you. Twyla Brace, Citizens Council for Health Freedom. There are several things, and sometimes, you know, when you sit in a committee, you just have an opportunity to see things that you hadn't seen before or hear about them. So I just want to pull out three concerns that we have. One is on page 16 and this new central state database for maltreatment. We're not in support of central databases, believe things should be kept locally, don't want to build new big systems. On page 62, where it talks about the state shall create a diagnostic manual, and I know that the testifier said this has to do with the ICD-9-10 codes, at least I thought that's what he was referring to. Well, it's a little bit of a concern. There is a diagnostic manual. It's one diagnostic manual. Everybody uses it. The idea that the commissioner would develop a manual of diagnostic codes to be used in definition of emotional disturbance and mental illness for a statewide mental health system is a concern to us. We don't know what they pick. I mean, what will they pick? I mean, there are some very interesting things in the diagnostic manual that would really surprise you. So, and then according to that, of course, all the rest of this follows. The other thing I would say is the ICD-10 coding system has been put on hold because of the controversy. And because I didn't come here prepared with the numbers, I'll give you some sort of numbers. There's something like, I don't know if it was like 18,000 of one code, but what we're talking about is up to like, I think it's like 144,000 total codes in the ICD-9 code. The the Wall Street Journal talked about it and talked about the nine codes that are having related to birds. There are new codes having to be related to burns while you are water skiing. It's so specific and so detailed, creating this information, and it's very costly for all the providers to actually have all this brand new coding system. And so it's been put on hold as of just recently. I think it was last week. And then the last thing is page 70, 71, 92, and 93, all having to do with this new situation with the Indians and the waiver of the premiums, and it also mentions assets. And so one thing is it's a concern of ours that the state just follows along with whatever the feds say. But the second thing is who's paying that? I heard them say there's no cost. Well, if you're getting care, there's a cost. And so who's actually paying for the premium? There has to be a cost to this. And so I'm wondering if it's a cost to the state. Clearly, it's not a cost to the American Indians, but somebody is paying the bill. It's a cost to the feds. We're paying for it through taxpayer dollars, but somebody's paying the bill. So these are the three items that I pulled out sort of on the fly here that are concerns of ours and that we would like dealt with differently. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Brace. Senator Nina, comments? Any questions for Ms. Brace? Mr.
Madam Chair, we do have an A4 amendment that I'd like to offer. But before we do that, I'd like to just orally amend the A3 language. There's a report on page 4, and it says there'll be a biennial report to the chairs. I just would like to include and ranking minority members.
Thank you, Senator Nienau. Senator Nienau moves the oral amendment on what line is that?
410.
410 to include the ranking minority members. All those in favor with that oral amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
And Madam Chair, there's an A4 amendment that I would offer up, and Mr. Kevin Goodnow would like to speak to that. I think there's peace in the valley on this. Okay. This committee heard this similar issue last year on a bill that I had. Madam Chair.
Thank you. And so Senator Nina moves the A4 amendment.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is an amendment that's based on an issue that was brought before the committee last year on the 72.5% requirement related to personal care assistance. What we have in the language that's being added is when doing the calculation on the 72.5% that the revenue generated or the expenses related to the qualified professional, who is the professional that's overseeing the personal care assistance, is not included in the calculation, the 72.5%. Been working with the agencies, the advocacy groups, talked to Senator Lori, and everybody is good with this. There are some other issues we're trying to work on we haven't been able to resolve yet, but this language that we have right here is peace in the valley, as Senator Nienau mentioned.
We like that. Any questions for Mr. Goodnow? Senator Nienau renews his motion on A4 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, nay. Amendment is adopted.
Senator Nee, now this goes to judiciary, so perhaps in judiciary we can address some of the concerns.
Madam Chair,
it would be nice to keep
I would move
working.
That the bill as amended be sent to be recommended to pass and sent to judiciary. I'm sorry, there's someone wants to testify.
Okay. Hello. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Eric Hauge with AFSCME Council 5. I'll be brief. In Section 3, or in Article 3, we have some questions about the language which encourages and requires the use of volunteers, religious organizations, social clubs, civic service organizations in developing the service and support plan and the impact that that could have on the workers who have the necessary training and background to carry out the work. I understand the intent and support the direction the bill is going and fully understand the necessity of engaging the community in the care of our elders. Volunteers and civic organizations have always played a vital role in ensuring the needs of our elders are met. However, we need to draw a clear distinction, I think, between volunteer services and the care provided by professionals on the ground. I've talked to the department about this, and I'm hopeful that we can work out some clarifying language to address these questions before the bill makes its way to judiciary.
That would be great, Mr. Hauge, to continue the conversations and make sure that everybody has a comfort level, because I don't think the intentions were anything
absolutely
negative. So Senator Nee now renews his motion for Senate file 1804 as amended be recommended to pass. Any further questions from the committee? This bill would be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in – oh, Senator Higgins.
Madam Chair, I'm just looking at the A2 amendment we just passed, and it's coded 1679 A2. So I don't know.
No, we had – Senator Higgins, we had the A3 and the A4.
Oh, that's the old one.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
Shut up, Linda.
Okay. I'm glad you're paying attention, Senator Higgins. The motion is renewed. Any further questions? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Nee, now for taking this bill.
Thank you very much, everybody.